Hello and good morning. We are going to talk a little bit about chapter 5 today. We are going to talk about evaluating art. When it comes to evaluating art, what we are actually doing is selecting one thing over another. We like to evaluate things like the creative process. When it comes to evaluation, you are appreciating the specialness of something. We are looking at things like quality. When it comes to evaluating quality, you could say that it is relative between people and cultures. In other words, it really depends on the time, it depends on the geography, it depends on things like age. You can say that evaluation really is different and it is really based on the individual. So when it comes to evaluating quality, we like to think about things like whether or not a work of art was done skillfully. If you think about the art in the Western world, we like to think about art and right away we expect that we are going to look at a work of art and judge it based on the amount of skill it took to create something. And so you can say that skill is a sought after trait when it comes to looking at works of art. But in another culture, like in China, it's very different. Instead, they look for something that is called a quote unquote life breath. And so what do we mean by that? What many Chinese artists do, maybe if we can think back a little bit about some of the works we've seen in previous chapters. There's a lot of landscapes. There's a lot of more expressive landscapes that are done in black and white, most likely done in ink. And something that you'll notice, there's a lot of open negative space. I'll show you guys an example of that eventually. And so what do they mean by life breath? Basically, the idea isn't really to capture accuracy when it comes to drawing or painting a landscape. Instead, they try to exaggerate it so that it can bring out a life on its own. And so that is just one way to describe it. So when it comes to this evaluation, it really changes a lot, especially in the Western world, especially in Europe. So the reputation of evaluation is constantly changing. And so something that we should try to remember, this will probably be on the quiz or the exam, value judgments necessarily involve subjectivity. So whenever it comes to judgments, we don't really like to take it as concrete information because, again, it's very subjective. It all really depends on the individual. It is very difficult to tell my students that this is good work when everyone has their own different tastes. Maybe I don't have the same taste as my students. And so, yes, when it comes to looking at art, overall, it really helps out a lot to be open-minded because you'll hear different opinions from anybody and it can change rather quickly. And so let's take a look at this first work of art here. This painting, maybe some of you are looking at this work of art and you're wondering, is it good art? Let's take a look at it. And we are looking at this work of art. Okay, what is it? It is of a portrait. It is of the corner of a woman's face or a girl's face. We see the eye, very strong focal point within the whole composition. We see hair draping over the face. And so I'm gonna ask you, do you think this is strong work? Do you like this work? And I can safely say that half of my class would like it while the other half would not. And so Let's think about why we would like it first. Well, first of all, it's pretty sweet in that it looks like it was done as a reflection of somebody that was probably admired somehow, and that the artist found beauty in the subject. And so there's a little bit of this sweet characteristic when it comes to looking at the painting, and therefore we can appreciate it. But if we look at it from a formal point of view, and this can be more leaning towards students that don't really like this work of art, you can look at it and say that the form isn't exactly there. And what we mean by that is it is of a face, but it feels like it's lacking depth, especially if I were to look at the top part, especially the forehead. I like to see a little bit of shadow there to signify the separation between the hair and the forehead, and the skin underneath the forehead feels very flat. And again, there's not really enough shadow to create depth. And on that area, if I were to scroll down a little bit to the lower part of the chin, that part, it feels like it is very flat. It looks like the skin isn't even being pushed. It's not curved around the cheekbone like I'm expecting when it comes to looking at a portrait. And the eye has a lot of really strong white pigment when it comes to looking at eyes. And when I see artists putting a lot of white in the white part of the eye, that's when I know they are a amateur. But it's somewhat accurate. I think the proportions might be there, but when it comes to form, I can tell you that this is not a strong painting. It looks like it was done by someone that does not really know form, that maybe should take an art class or two. And so this work is called Shy Glance by Dawn Marie Jingagian, made in 1976. Acrylic on canvas, 24 inches by 18 inches. And if you look at the place where it is being shown, the Museum of Bad Art in what appears to be Dedham, Massachusetts, recovered from a trash bin. Oh my God. And lacking skill, but embarrassingly sweet. So, very subjective. Some of us like it, some of us don't like it. Overall, if it were me, no. It's a little bit too much flatness. I'm really picky on that. And so let's move on to the next painting here. And when it comes to looking at a portrait in the Western world, this is basically what we expect. We want clarity, we want vividness, we want strong contrasting colors. And what I mean by that is if you look at the fabric and how the model or the self-portrait, the woman is wearing dark clothing to balance off the light fabric and even the feather in her head and on her hat, you can say that the composition is very well thought. It's very strong in terms of capturing what we are looking for when it comes to evaluating art and saying this is an example of beautiful art. And so, very expressive for the person to be holding this palette of paint on her arm. She's holding the brushes. And so, it's almost perfect in terms of what we are looking for in a self-portrait. But when it comes to evaluating art, say that we see this type of work all the time. Do you feel like that judgment still holds value? Or do you think that we should push ourselves beyond something like this? Because after a while, we become almost desensitized by that same amount of stimulation. We are seeing portraits, we are seeing beautiful portraits in the Western world, And they all have accuracy, they all have clarity, they have this fulfilling negative space. And so we have to ask ourselves, is that exactly what contributes to good art? Okay. Self-portrait, Vigée Le Brun, great assuredness of anatomy, may seem conventional to the contemporary eye. And so what do we mean by that? Basically, it's easy for the current audience to enjoy it. And I don't know about you, but for me, it doesn't spark anything special. And so again, we are evaluating work, and it really depends on the individual. I can tell you that, maybe I can never paint like that, but part of me doesn't really want to either, because yes, it is something that has been done in the past, and people, they've been able to do that for, 200 years. Do I still want to do that too? So yeah, many perspectives are different depending on the individual. And so when it comes to evaluating work, what we find in a work depends on what we are looking for. These things are personal value judgments. It also involves the viewer's personality. And so if you can think back about my little explanation earlier, in a way, I do have an expectation when it comes to looking at works of art. And that is really my own personal value judgment. And it does involve my personality. So perhaps you could ask yourself, what kind of art do I like? What kind of art do I not exactly care for? So we can ask ourselves these things throughout this little chapter. When it comes to evaluating, we like to begin with an open mind to go beyond snap judgments. And what we mean by that is try not to judge it too fast. I'm gonna glance at a painting and, oh yeah, that's good, but I should take a little bit more time to determine whether or not it really is good. We like to practice seeing rather than looking, so hopefully we can remember the difference there. When it comes to seeing, we want to spend a little bit more time. We want to look with a little bit of memory or intention. And so now we're going to talk a little bit about art criticism. When it comes to this term here, we're making discriminating judgments, both favorable and unfavorable. And we are going to talk about three basic art criticism theories. And this is one of the few lists that I ask you guys to remember. So there are three basic formal art criticism theories. It's a lot to remember, but I think if you think about the terminology we already learned, this should be somewhat second nature. You should connect them. And so the first basic theory is formal art criticism. So formal art criticism is criticism based off of looking at how a work is made. We are looking at parts of a composition coming together. We are thinking about organization. Something that comes with formal art criticism is we value innovation and style above all. We like to see when artists can pull off something new and fresh, and it's somewhat of an ongoing trend that we always like to look for whatever is going to become the next big thing. When it comes to criticizing works of art formally, we like to compare it to the work's contemporaries. In other words, we like to compare it to whatever else is going on at the time. You can say that during the Renaissance, despite the great artist that we might already know, such as Michelangelo or Da Vinci, you can say that Raphael was also one of the stronger high Renaissance artists, but at the same time, you probably didn't get as much recognition as the other two, but again, people are constantly comparing work to their contemporaries. And so again, when it comes to formal art criticism, we are basically talking about how a work is made, how it looks in terms of its composition. So whenever it comes to formal or form, think about the way it looks. Just the way it looks, and also how it was made. And let's take a look at this painting here. I'm hoping that you guys can look at the links that I attached to our module. This is one of them, the Pietà by Titian. Okay, so if I were to look at this and think about formal art criticism, I am going to think about what I am looking at. What is this form? What is the composition that I'm trying to evaluate? And so right away, we can say there are a lot of dark, muted colors, and that is a part of formal art criticism because it deals with form. There's a lot of muted colors, a lot of dark colors. There's a very interesting diagonal line in the very center. If you look at the sculpture on the left, and then we see the next figure down, it looks like maybe Mary Magdalene, and we see Mary next to her, and then Christ. So we have this interesting diagonal composition, very asymmetrical diagonal. And then you see the Cupid or the angel. Yes, probably not Cupid, but an angel on the upper right-hand corner, offsetting this diagonal being created by the figures below. And so there's a very strong diagonal there. There's a symmetry happening with the negative space. We see this apse within maybe a church altar. And so I'm judging the formal qualities of this piece. And that's what formal art criticism is all about. Really just talking about the way it looks. Something that we can talk about as well when it comes to formal art criticism, it looks like an oil painting, and that the brush strokes feel very expressive. They're not as smooth or as glazed as a typical Renaissance painting, like a Da Vinci painting. Instead, there's a little bit of looseness in there. And so this is by Titian, Pietà, made in 1576, oil on canvas, very large painting, 149 inches by 136 inches. And so keep in mind that we are just talking about this work in terms of its form, in terms of its formal criticism. Formal criticism, basically how it looks. And now let's talk about the form of this work here. Very different work of art in comparison to what we just saw. And so if I were to evaluate this work of art, I can say that it is very bright and colorful. There's some interesting abstract shapes, some interesting abstract rectangular and triangular patterns. There are some hints of abstraction, especially with how the values are being painted. There's a little bit of dark to light happening. There's a very interesting circle on the upper right-hand corner. Perhaps it is a sun. It kind of reminds me of cubism. We haven't talked about that just yet in class, but so now I'm giving us some qualities of the form still, talking about the way it looks. Greens, yellows, pinks, and reds. And this work is by Delaunay Turk, Simultaneous Contrasts. This is a novel treatment of a landscape as the subject. And so, yes, it looks very much like an abstract landscape. And the qualities that I mentioned earlier, the lines, the shapes, the colors, we are all talking still about form, still talking about formal art criticism. Okay? And now let's move on to the next piece. Still, let's have this idea in mind that we're talking about its more formal qualities, the way it looks. I see three sections. It is a triptych. A triptych is a type of painting where there are three sections that were meant to be put together. A lot of dark colors, a lot of strong contrasting colors within the painting with the white lines and the yellow lines. I see some interesting text, and that the text and even the lines themselves were written in a very interesting manner. Not exactly straight, not exactly defined. There's a little bit of a expressive quality to the lines. It's as though the artist tried to make the lines feel more on the naive side. And look at the center. I see a very interesting face in that expression. Very interesting expression. Okay, so all of these things that I'm talking about now is really how it looks. We're talking about the formal criticisms here. Jean-Michel Basquiat, Horn Players, 1983. Very large painting, 8 feet by 6 feet, 6.5 feet. And Basquiat is one of the most successful painters of our time. And we look at this work, and right away we are discussing form, and a lot of us will probably look at it and say, you know what? I don't know. I can't really tell you if it's really strong art or not, because there's somewhat of a more instinctive quality. It's as though the artist didn't really care about whether or not there's accuracy, and that's one of the things that people actually find charming about the piece, and that's what I enjoy about the piece. I like the spontaneous nature of the lines. It mentions here it looks improvised, but it's actually the result of discipline. And so those were examples of form or formal art criticism. Now we're going to talk a little bit about another basic art criticism theory, which is contextual. Contextual is when we think about or we examine environmental influences on a work of art. We are thinking about these outside influences when it comes to the work of art. So it could be things like the economic system. And what is being meant by that is perhaps the painting was made to be sold for money, and that it was made to be bought, and that there's a reason why it was actually being made. When it comes to context, we could think about things like cultural values. So again, we are thinking about the necessity of it, the outs these These somewhat external factors that don't exactly deal with form, with the way it looks. Instead, it's something about what the culture might expect or what the culture might need. And when it comes to contextual art criticism, we could think about things like politics. And so we have all of these things to talk about when it comes to works of art in context, but we can ask ourselves this question: what else was going on at the time? And that's probably the easiest way to remember context. We talked a little bit about content in the previous chapter, which is more about the message or the meaning. So it's somewhat of a inner explanation. When it comes to context, it's more about the outside. So it's probably good to think about it that way. Context, think outside, think external or environmental, whatever is around it. And so if we were to go back to looking at some of these works that we just talked about, let's go back to the Pietà by Titian. And if we talk about its contextual characteristics, you can say, for one, it was an altarpiece for the public viewing in a chapel. So it was made in order to embellish the inner walls of a church. It was made for that particular purpose. Something about the contextual characteristics about this work. It was made during a time of epidemic of plague. So, because it was made during this time, it might carry over a particular emotion or a feeling, which is something we're gonna talk about a little bit later, but for now, it's more about we're still talking about context, so we're talking about these external qualities, these environmental qualities, and it was made during this time, during the epidemic time. And so it's carrying over some of these qualities of mortality and grief. So remember, contextual context, think outside. So it was made for a church. It was made to be, it was probably a commission of some sort. It was made in Europe, in probably most likely Italy. It was made during the epidemic. So these are all external characteristics. Okay? So form, basically, we're talking about the way it looks. Context, we're talking about the way it is being seen with these somewhat outside influences. So contexting outside influences. Now let's go back to the Delaunay Turk, simultaneous contrast. Some contextual characteristic about this work is that it seems to be a sunlit landscape. It was inspired by this scientist, Michel Eugène Chevreul, and that this scientist did a research on the law of simultaneous contrast. So there's actually a research document based off of the same title. And something that artists often do is they actually are very inspired by the current happenings. And so this was happening at the time. This was a big topic. This simultaneous contrast theory was talked about a lot, and so the artist made a piece about that. And so that's another example of contextual art criticism. We can connect these things based off of these external influences. So think time, think place, whatever is happening at the time. And finally, contextual criticism when it comes to the Basquiat. It was made due to the inspiration of this movement of jazz in the 1940s. So it was based off of something from the past, but it was during this time. It was made to reflect a particular time. So again, we're thinking about some of these external influences. If we look at some of the figures there, there's a person with the ear cut off on the upper left-hand corner. It was made to represent this person, Charlie Parker. He was a musician that died young, and that he cut off his ear to reflect that of Van Gogh. Maybe some of us are aware of Van Gogh's story that he cut off part of his ear, and so. So Basquiat made this painting of this musician that, in a way, died a little bit too early. He died before his prime. Something else about the piece, Ornithology, is a song or a track recorded by that artist, by Charlie Parker, and another artist, Dizzy Gillespie. So, again, context, think outside, think external influence, time, think place. Okay. And now let's talk about the third basic art criticism theory, which is expressive. And when it comes to expressive, we're thinking about who made it. We are thinking about who is he or who is she. We are looking for personal meaning, some deep psychological insight or human concern. It's also a type of psychoanalysis and gender studies. And so let me go ahead and I'm going to pause here. This will be the end of part one of this chapter, and I will continue this in just a second, just a minute maybe. Welcome back. This is part two of the Evaluating Art chapter. We talked about two art criticisms so far. We talked about the formal, we talked about contextual. Now we're going to talk about the expressive. So what is the expressive art criticism about? We are thinking about who made it. Who is she? Who is he? We are looking for personal meanings, deep psychological insight, or human concern, psychoanalysis, and gender studies. When it comes to these expressive art criticism theories, we are really trying to figure out who is this person? What were they like? And so on. If we go back to the Pietà by Titian, some expressive characteristics about this piece is that it was made during his last year of life. And because it was made during this artist's last year of him living, you can say that the painting has this somber reflection of mortality. And you could probably say that the muted colors, the dark composition may perhaps adds on to this effect in terms of this somber quality. If we think about the expressive qualities of the painting we looked at earlier, the simultaneous contrasts, you can say that it is compared to the artist's ebullient personality. The color palette recalls bright folk costumes of the native Ukraine. And so when it comes to these expressive qualities, it is something that is very personal of the artist. You can tell what he or she was feeling. You can tell things like their culture sometimes. And if we look at the expressive qualities of this piece here, the Basquiat painting, it is like a three-verse song. The artist is African American. If you were to look at his line quality, it feels very intense. He has very strong purpose behind the qualities of his mark making. So that is what the expressive art criticism is all about. Basically, who or how was this person like? And so we're going to shift into a different subject here. What makes art great? You can say that there's a very strong connection with the dollar value and how sought after the work of art is, and the record holding of a painting ever sold is $119.9 million for Edvard Munch's The Scream. It mentions here, the dollar values only loosely correlate with historical importance or innovation of a work. So you can say that the subject matter may not reflect how strong a work of art is. We look at The Scream. We are looking at a very expressive work. It's not exactly representational. It is not exactly accurate, and you can say that there is a lot of skill involved, and I can tell you that the painting itself is very creative, and it's very difficult to pull off the same exact style as Edvard Munch. And so this painting, it's not exactly saying anything that is important in terms of the art world, there is no really strong cultural significance. But you wouldn't be able to tell that just from the amount of money people are willing to spend just to own it. So what makes art great? We can't really say that the painting, the subject matter is really that important. There's something else, and that is more about innovation and who did what first. So when it comes to a terminology such as a masterpiece, you can say that it has to have at least one element of art criticism to be strongly present. Whenever there is a masterpiece, we usually find them in a museum. Self-examination can uncover why a viewer values a work as great. I like to think of a masterpiece as one of the artist's strongest works. Say that there is an exhibition by the artist, and that the artist is showing many of his most popular works. I would say that the masterpiece is the greatest example of among all of those works. And so there are different ways to evaluate works of art, and we can do that through writing. And these are the methods to write about art. One is to get the facts about the work. We need the name of the creator, the title, the date, the subject, the medium, size, and location of the work. If it is a reproduction, we have to clarify the original medium and size. And you'll see a lot of that, especially when we look at things like ancient Greek or Roman sculpture. There's a lot of reproductions, and many times they do this to save the original because they don't want anything to happen to it, or they like to just make them for the sake of sales. They just want to make the same thing because people are willing to buy it. And when it comes to writing about art, we need to get the facts about the work, but also we need to analyze the work. We have to think about the parts of the work and how they fit together. We have to think about the formal elements, context, and the artist's input. And the other method to write about art is through evaluating. So we are going to assess the quality or importance of the work in relation to art criticism technique. We like to look for innovation. What is new? Does it move your feelings? We like to talk about a reflection of a time period or maybe a personality. Maybe we like to write about it simply because it is beautiful or challenging to the eye. So now we're going to talk a little bit about censorship. Censorship is the ultimate evaluation, and that is when there is the alteration or removal of works of art from a public view. These are usually carried out because of religious, moral, or political reasons. So when censorship does occur, artists' freedom takes a backseat to values of civil authorities. And what is being said here is that when it comes to artwork, especially when it is viewed in public, you can say that the government has the final say. They can evaluate it and determine whether or not it is good enough to be seen by the public. So censorship is something that has been practiced over history. The Byzantine Empire, these early Christian empire, and there was this iconoclastic controversy of destroying religious images. So during this time in early Christianity, there was rules stating that they are not allowed to make works of art based off of images in the Bible. And you can say that we can ask ourselves, why was this taboo, or why was this illegal in the past in comparison to what we are seeing today? We see many images that deal with Christianity, but in the past they were not allowed to create these images because what people were saying was people were worshiping the objects, and that they were, worshiping a statue or a painting, and that Christians at the time were not supposed to do that. And of course, a lot of that has changed. You can say that it's not exactly this idea of worshiping the object, the artwork itself, but instead it's more of a reminder. It reminds worshippers to think of Christ, to think of their own religion, so they changed that rule. And censorship was practiced in this work of art here. Maybe some of you recognize it, The Last Judgment by Michelangelo. If you look at the figures, you can see that they are primarily of nude men. When this painting was initially created, Michelangelo painted every figure in the nude, but later popes found out that the people that were entering the church and that they were looking at these images, so they noticed some of them would say it's a little bit too graphic. So what a pope eventually did was hire another artist to paint loincloths over their genitals. So yes, censorship is the ultimate evaluation. So it is usually carried over through the government or the church. Censorship played a big part in Nazi Germany. There was this confiscation of over 16,000 modern art pieces. Actually, artists were banned from working. And what was happening at the time was, you can say that the leader of the Nazi regime, Adolf Hitler, he actually was an artist too. I wouldn't say he was a successful artist, but he too was an artist, but he did not like modern art. He did not like abstract. He did not like non-objective works of art. He was more of a traditional art lover. He only liked things like portraits and paintings that were representational. And that's how influential he was as a leader. He was able to convince the country that this is the kind of art that should be shown here, and not this kind of expressive, abstract art. In a way, he was trying to control people's ability to think outside the box. Another example of censorship was this case here in the United States, Miller versus California, 1973. It mentions that work may only be censored if it is demonstrably obscene to the average person. So if we were to get a room of people, and let's say there's 50 people in the room, if it was offensive to half of the people there, then they would probably censorship. They would probably put it down. So I'm not exactly sure how they would measure that, but you can say that it really depends on the audience again. So when it comes to this artwork, the freedom of individual expression valued is it's not exactly a freedom of expression. It is only freedom that is allowed. So something about artwork and censorship, if a work benefits from public funds, it may be controversial. In other words, if the government commissioned a work that this money is coming from the people's tax, from the people's tax money, there's going to be a lot of questions to why they would actually fund that work, because in a way it's almost like saying this is the kind of art that we want to see, that they want people to see, and it's going to in a way support a particular idea. So when it comes to artwork, we have to be conscious of these works that are being publicly funded. And if we look at this example here, it looks like a abstract painting. If you notice the garment, the light blue clothing on a woman, maybe if you are familiar with many works of Christianity, you'll often see the Virgin Mary wearing light blue. And if you look at this piece, a lot of abstract shapes, it looks like flowers and looks like rocks. Very expressive expression on the face there. This is called Holy Virgin Mary, 1996, by Chris Ofili. And so this painting, you're probably wondering, I just heard the title, Holy Virgin Mary. But when I look at the piece, I'm not really sure if that is symbolic of what I'm used to when it comes to a depiction of Mary. And so the artist here, something that you'll notice on the painting itself, there are three rocks, or actually one, two, looks like four rocks. And they are not rocks. They are actually elephant dung. And so when people saw this painting and they realized that there is elephant dung on the piece, they try to censor it. They try to shut it down. And so in 1999, the New York City mayor Giuliani tried to close down the Brooklyn Museum because of this painting. It is very offensive to Roman Catholicism, but at the same time, something about Chris Ofili, he is from Africa, and that in his culture, they actually use elephant dung as one of their more important types of media when it comes to creating art. So is it really offensive? We have to question ourselves. What is the artist really trying to say? Are we holding our standards of value higher than others? And so a very interesting piece of a very interesting controversy created by this work of art. And so another thing that I don't have a picture of this. In 2010, there was a nudity controversy on YouTube by the artist Amy Greenfield. She actually posted videos of herself in the nude and that she was on the beach. And that, if I can recall, I think she was rolling around on the beach. But she would publish her work and say that it is art. And so she's wondering why people are getting offended by that. So I wonder what you would think if you were to see a nude figure on the beach and you were to watch that on YouTube, basically in public for millions of people to possibly watch. Do you feel like that's good? Do you feel like that's good for the public, or do you feel like it's fine because it is art? Which side are you on? I'm kind of curious about that. I can tell you that me as a grown up, I have children, and I would feel a little bit concerned if my son was to watch something like that on YouTube. Yeah. When you're young, you think, yeah, it's fine, but when you get older, you think twice. Maybe it's not so good for kids. So, everyone has their own opinion, of course. Another similar controversy was on Facebook, where there were drawings of models, nude models, being published on the ever popular website, and it was being published by the New York Academy of Art. So this, I would feel differently too in comparison to the Amy Greenfield, because they're drawings. At least this is my opinion. When it comes to art and when it comes to nudity, for some reason, if it's a drawing, it's not really as it doesn't really carry the same weight as video. So, what do you guys think? Do you think that too is a little bit too offensive, or do you think it's okay? You probably think the Amy Greenfield video is okay too. So, yes, everyone has their own opinion on this. And if we took a look at this example, we are looking at a very large wall mural. Looks like a mixed media piece with photography and some drawing and a little bit of painting. You might see figures of people of different ages, of different social backgrounds. I see a worker on the left side. I see children. I see what appears to be, I'm not, they look like early travelers into the United States. I see people holding up signs. It looks like they're holding up protest signs. I see people holding hammers. It looks a little bit like conflict and protest, if anything. And so this is a painting by Judy Taylor, History of Labor in Maine, 2007. And when this mural was created, it was actually being told to be put down because it's a little bit too political. And in a way, it's showing a little bit of bias towards organized labor and what organized labor is really about. Basically, a way for workers to bond together if anything was to be done by these big businesses. So when big businesses saw this painting, they felt like it was an attack against them, and they asked for it to be taken down.